Well, as David said, today is Together Sunday, and this is a Sunday that we have set aside in the life of the church to remember and to give thanks for our unity, our oneness as a church. And so we are worshiping together. This is a new thing for us. We haven't done this in the past. And then we'll go outside after the service and enjoy fellowship together. But the reason why we're doing this and lifting up our oneness is because unity lies at the very heart of who we are as a people. We are called as the church to be one. This community right here, gathered in this church, God desires us to be one. Now we see this fairly clearly in our gospel reading this morning. Our gospel reading comes from the 17th chapter from John's gospel. It's found at the very end of the Last Supper narrative. And you may remember that in John's gospel, the Last Supper takes up a significant portion of that gospel. So by the time we get to our reading in chapter 17, Jesus has already spoken to his disciples for four chapters. This is his last night with them before his crucifixion. So he is giving them his last set of instructions. So he teaches them. But then in chapter 17, there's a shift away from the dialogue with the disciples to prayer. And Jesus turns to the Father, and he prays this lengthy prayer, takes up the entire 17th chapter, but a prayer for the disciples in that room and the disciples who are to come, us. And so what does he pray for? Well, he names a number of things, but the core thing that he prays for is for our unity. On his last night, that's Jesus' concern. That's his desire. That his disciples in that room, his disciples who are to come, that they will be one. Let me read to you just a short section of our passage. And if you're looking at the bulletin, this begins at the third paragraph. It's towards the end of the prayer, and Jesus prays this. I ask not only on behalf of these, so those are the disciples in the room, but also on behalf of those who will believe in me through their word. So that's us. That they may all be one. As you, Father, are in me, and I am in you, may they also be in us. So that the world may believe that you have sent me. The glory that you have given me, I have given them so that they may be one. As we are one, I and them, and you and me, that they may become completely one. Now, as I was reflecting on this passage this week, and all this language about you being in me, I in you, the image that came to me was an image of the Book of Kells. Some of you have probably seen the Book of Kells. It's in Dublin. It's a beautifully illuminated copy of the Gospels produced in the 9th century. But every page is a masterpiece. There are these beautiful drawings in which lines are interwoven, designs are turning in and around each other. There are pictures of plants and animals, human beings and angels, and they all connect. They all come together. It's this beautiful image of how God's world, in God's world, all things were meant to be woven together. And that's especially true of the church. We are meant to be woven together, our lives woven together. The church is to be a witness to the reconciling love of God in Christ. And so we are to manifest to the world the unity that God desires, the unity that God will bring about, we are to foreshadow it. And so this unity is not really an option for us. There is a gospel imperative for us to participate in this unity. This is part of our identity, and this is part of what it means to be a Christian. In the 1920s, there was a young man named David Martin Lloyd-Jones. He would go on to become one of the great preachers of the 20th century. But in the 20s, he's a young man. He is studying to be a physician. He is acknowledged as a brilliant student. He's at the top of his medical school class. And after he finishes his medical school and then finishes his residency, he is snatched up to become the assistant to Lord Thomas Horder, who is physician to the crown. He's the royal physician. So Lloyd-Jones is put in this prestigious position early in life. But then he has this conversion experience. He's baptized into the church, and his life begins to change. But he says that he has this gnawing question that sticks with him after his baptism and conversion. And that is, he keeps asking himself, is this real? My conversion, is God part of this? Is God really working in my life, changing me? And he says this question remained with him until he had this one experience. And this one experience, it allowed him to say, yes, it was real. Something did happen to me when I became a Christian. This was the experience. As part of his conversion, he decided to leave medicine and go into the ministry. And his first church that he was called to was to a very small and very poor church on the coast of Wales. Now, we have to remember at this point in English society, there was a very strong class system. Society was stratified. And so he shows up to this church, and he's from a well-to-do family. He's been at the best schools. He's been in this prestigious position. And all of a sudden, he finds he is ministering to Christians who were at the very bottom of the social ladder. Most were fishermen, again, very poor, largely illiterate. And the experience he had, and he said that this shocked him, is he found that he had a bond with them. There was this joy, this closeness, this love for them. And he found that he was learning from them, which he says went against everything that he had been taught. Everything in his training had taught him that these people were below him. In fact, that's one reason he would feel good about himself. But all of a sudden, they didn't feel below him anymore. And he realized at that point that he really had changed, that something had rearranged the furniture of his identity. And he writes this, "I felt a oneness with people of different classes, people who, if I wasn't a Christian, I would never have given the time of day, people with whom I wouldn't have felt any unity at all. With them, I felt this oneness." This week, I came upon a commentator who shared a story about a conversation he had with a man from Bosnia. This conversation took place in the early 2000s after the Bosnian War. And the gentleman from Bosnia had immigrated to the U.S., so he was a U.S. citizen now. And they were talking about politics and elections. And the man from Bosnia said, "You know, here in America, the Democrats and the Republicans, they really hate each other." And he said, "I'm a Democrat. I've decided I'm going to be a Democrat. But I'll tell you this, if I meet a Bosnian who's a Republican, politics don't matter. We are one." And so the commentator asked, well, why? Why are you one? And he says, "It's because we have both been through life and death together. We have been through the same experience in Bosnia together, life and death." Ephesians chapter 2, says that you were dead in your trespasses and sin, but now you have been made alive in Jesus Christ. As Christians, we have faced our sin, our brokenness, our alienation from God way beyond what the ordinary person believes about themselves. And then at the same time, we have been infinitely affirmed by the unconditional love and grace of God through Jesus. And this love, it lifts us higher than anyone else goes. Now, if you have been through life and death like that, then it doesn't matter about the race, it doesn't matter about the class, it doesn't matter about the politics, because the gospel, it cuts through all of this. As Lloyd-Jones realized, it changes your identity. It changes the very furniture of your heart. And the things that looked really important to you before, they don't seem that important. The divisions don't seem that important. Again, we as the church, we are called to be one. And I think it's important to note that as we talk about this unity that we're called to, it is a different type of unity than the unity that culture speaks about. When our culture talks about unity, often it's speaking about a kind of inclusion, an acceptance of one another, an acceptance of our differences. It means a kind of a coexistence. But that's not the unity that Jesus is talking about. His unity is far more radical, because what he is calling us to is he's calling us to a unity that is rooted in love, a love that knits us together, again, weaves us together, a love that allows us to live our lives for one another. So what does that look like in practice? If we are to be one, as Jesus prays, what's the fruit of that? How might we live that out? A couple thoughts from the scriptures. And by the way, these things may sound a little radical, but I would say the way of Jesus is radical. But the first thing we need to think about in terms of oneness is that the unity we're called to is a unity in which first we are one in sharing our possessions. I think that's the first point about our unity. We are to be one in sharing our possessions. Acts chapter 4 says of the early church, no one treated their possessions as if they were their own. Now, this doesn't mean that there wasn't private property in the early church. There was private property. But what it does mean is that in the early church, there was this drastic open-handedness. The gospel changed their hearts towards their possessions. And so what you see is you see them sharing their homes, their money, their spaces. You see them sharing everything. And so the church should be one in sharing its possessions. Second, the church should be one in sharing our problems. Galatians 6 says we should bear one another's burdens. We are to bear our burdens together, to share our failures together. And this does mean that we need to be open about our burdens so that we can support one another with our problems. So one in our possessions, one in our problems. Third, we should be one in sharing truth. Ephesians 4 says, we must speak the truth in love to one another. All of us need a group of people who have the courage to tell us the truth, especially about ourselves, and to do it in love. When you have that, that is transformational. And then fourth, we should be one in showing forbearance to one another. Colossians 3 says, show forbearance to one another and forgive one another. Forgive as the Lord forgave you. Each one of us is a work in progress, and all of us are at different stages of our growth. And so we are to be patient with one another, as God is patient with us. And so that means if someone in the community hurts you, which they will if you're part of the community, it means you seek reconciliation and forgiveness. You seek unity. One in our possessions, one in our problems, one in truth, and one in showing forbearance. You know, this oneness, it is not our oneness. We don't create it. It is God's oneness. But the incredible invitation is that God invites us to share in this oneness by sharing in Him. So may we embrace it. May we live into it as we share in the oneness of God. That is Jesus' call to us today. Amen.